businesses that do open, you know, just for the sake of it, they don't stay open long enough to care, you know. And I think anyone who's actually, you know, probably listening to this podcast probably does care, and you know, they probably have compromised a lot and given up a lot to, you know, to pursue their dreams of being in business.
If you've been sticking with Dirty Linen this week, you will know that I am coming to you from Barcelona in Spain, where I am eating everything, all the things, drinking all the things as well, and really loving it. But my mind is still very much on Australia and the hospitality world there, because I know a lot of people are doing it really tough. I'm still hearing from, still in a lot of conversations, and keen to keep our conversation going on this podcast around hospitality and the big question of whether or not, hopefully not, it is broken. Someone that I've chatted to a couple of times around this, and I've always found his perspective so valuable, is Leon Kennedy. Leon is the CEO of Mulberry Group, and I'm super happy to welcome him to Dirty Linen today. Hey, Leon.
Hey, Danny. Thanks for having me.
So good to have you on the show. Thank you for making the time. I'll just get you to, you know, put yourself in context for us. Tell us a bit about yourself and how you come to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. No problem. I mean, I have sort of been in hospitality my whole life, really. Like, I, you know, my dad was a chef. So always kind of spent a lot of time in the kitchens, and growing up with a, you know, intrinsic kind of, you know, value and appreciation for food and the way that it's prepared. I was not very good at school, not very good at high school, and didn't spend a lot of time going, and spent a lot of time skateboarding and partying instead. So that didn't really set me up for a very long career in academia or university. And so pretty quickly out of high school, I managed to get a job in hospitality, and I've kind of never looked back from there. Like, I've kind of, you know, dabbled in a few different career paths. Like, I've been a business owner in hospitality for a very long time. And then, you know, really found something in business and maybe at the nexus of business and hospitality that has given me a lot of purpose in my life and a lot of meaning in my life. And I think once I found those two things and intertwined them together, I've been, you know, addicted ever since. And it's taken me down some really, really amazing pathways. You know, I spent a lot of time at Melbourne Business School, you know, getting an MBA and, you know, finding ways to sort of take that information and through business, you know, being able to bring that in an impactful way into hospitality, you know, an industry that I love so much. It's definitely been a very purposeful journey, I would say.
Wow, what an interesting story. And even just what you said now is so inspiring for people who are, you know, wondering where the path is going to take them. I suppose you just don't know, but there can be some really interesting and meaningful twists and turns along the way. When you say those words, impact and purpose and meaning, I start to see, you know, the fit with Mulberry Group. Tell people about the group, what drives it, and, you know, just basically what it is.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a really astute observation. You know, the Mulberry Group is a bit of an industry icon. You know, I've always felt that way, you know, long before I joined the group. Nathan Tolman is just one of those people who is just so naturally inspiring, and he's such a genius when it comes to hospitality. I think, you know, it was pretty easy for me to aspire to want to one day work in some capacity with him. And I think one of the things that has been so, you know, formative and so, I guess, attributable to Nathan's success is the fact that he's always so motivated by purpose and by impact. And, you know, it's kind of not the easiest thing to see from the outside looking in. I think that often what tends to happen with really incredible operators, especially in hospitality, is that they are very, very good at creating amazing stories, but they're not necessarily that focused on sharing those stories and, you know, advertising and marketing those stories. And I think the first part, though, you know, being motivated by a sense of purpose and impact is super, super important, you know. And Nathan is like the perfect evidence, I think, of what can be achieved when you start with that. You know, I think it's really easy in any industry, let alone hospitality, to just get caught up in a good idea, or you know, the novelty of you know, certain innovations and whatnot. And if you're not really anchored in what is purposeful and what you believe is impactful, then you can quite easily stray down the garden path. In our instance here at the Mulberry Group, it, you know, purpose and impact is literally at the heart of everything we do. You know, our entire purpose statement as an organization is about creating authentic experiences in a way that supports the communities around us so that we can create positive impact. You know, so when that is so central to everything we do and every decision that we make, it really closes that loop, you know. And when you work here and you experience the brand, you know, through the venues and whatnot, you can definitely feel that. Like we work really hard to make sure that is apparent in all of our sort of offerings.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because I could go to, let's say, Lilac, which is a cool wine bar in the back streets of Richmond. I could go to Hazel, which is a beautiful restaurant on Flinders Lane, or sneak downstairs to Dessous, the cool bar underneath. I could go and have some, you know, cool brunch at Square One down in the Rialto precinct. I mean, what is driving those businesses that I might not see as I sit there and casually drink a coffee or a glass of wine?
Yeah, sure. So, look, the most tangible thing that I can share is, you know, for us, 10% of our net profit from every single one of our venues gets donated to our farm. So we own a farm in Freshwater Creek called Common Ground Project, and that farm is a very, very special place. Like, it existed, you know, for quite some time before I joined the group. But I remember the first day that I went there, I was just blown away and just so inspired with just what the team were actually doing there. So the farm is primarily focused on two main areas, which is regenerative agriculture and supporting communities around this sort of area. So what that sort of looks like is, from a food perspective, you know, there's basically 4 and a bit acres that we look after. And it's when Felicity and Clary, who run the farm, when they took it over, it was virtually unfarmable. You know, the land had just been so overfarmed with cattle that the land was like concrete, and you know, it was just, the clay was just so hard. And you know, that was only a few years ago, whereas now, you know, when you look at the sort of, you know, aerial drone shots that we've taken, and you look at the sort of before and after, all of a sudden we've been able to replace that 4 acres with these patches now that are producing enough food for us to supply to our venues. And it's obviously, you know, it's really hard to produce enough food to provide, you know, to actually supply every single bit of produce that a restaurant will purchase. But every single time a customer goes into one of our venues, there's a pretty high likelihood that they're going to eat something that was grown at our farm. So that alone is a pretty special achievement. But the flip side to that, in terms of the, you know, the impact for people and how we want to support our communities, is we do a lot of work with asylum seekers at the farm and refugees. Like we there's a program that we have running, you know, all the time. We're actually in Melbourne Food and Wine, we're going to be doing an event at Dessous with this program. So the program's called Staying Grounded. And what we're really trying to achieve with this is we're trying to help and assist with assimilation. So what we tend to do with the program is we'll work with women in asylum seeker communities. And what we'll basically do is have them come and actually work on the farm with us. And usually what we do just throughout the year is we'll sort of run like an event with these women, where we'll do a dinner, and at the end of it, like we'll sell out the dinner. And in their time with us, it's so special because we actually get to learn all about their culture. You know, like we get to learn things, which is so awesome, and they get to kind of understand our culture. And you know, often we find that women come into that program barely speaking English, but we normally also find on the other side of it that usually 8 out of 10 of these women will end up in full-time employment, you know, around Geelong and around the Surf Coast. And to me, that's just an exceptional stat. You know, like when my family first came to Australia, like we lived in the commission flats, and, you know, understanding like how hard it is to actually assimilate into any foreign country you know, it's really, really challenging. And so to be able to have a program that really impacts that is, it's pretty special. And, you know, the possibility of being able to actually scale that is something that's just so inspiring and exciting as well. So yeah, the farm is obviously, very, very central to who we are as an organization. And we just believe that being focused on positive impact, being able to really, you know, put our money where our mouth is, for want of a better phrase, is critical. So by having the farm, it's one thing, but the farm's not for profit. So being able to support the farm through our venues and donate 10% of our net profit from every venue to the farm, that's significant. And where it becomes really tangible is for everyone out there, you know, in the public, for all of our customers. It's, it doesn't matter whether you go to Square One and buy a coffee or whether you go to Hazel and do the full chef's menu. Like, if you, whatever money you spend in one of our venues, you're part of that positive impact. You know, that's a brand promise that we can make and never ever have to worry about under delivering on.
Wow. So much in what you've just said, but one thing I want to say is that Clary's tomatoes that I had recently at Hazel were so delicious. The colour, the juiciness, just the sunshine. Oh, so good. Okay, so Leanne, you know, one of the big themes in this conversation around, you know, how tough hospitality is this idea of, you know, tiny restaurants perhaps being a model that can work and groups being a model that can work. But the people that are in the middle, the indie restaurants, you know, let's imagine them listening to this and thinking, well, I'm not going to buy a farm and 10% of my profits is, you know, really not very much. Are groups the only way that you can make this sort of impact or be purpose-driven, have a mission statement that, you know, you feel like you've got the headspace to not only embrace yourself but, you know, carry through to your teams and your customers? Are groups insulated in a way, and are independent restaurants, do independent restaurants have a chance?
I guess the way I'd approach that question is that's probably the first thing I would challenge is that I don't subscribe to that. I don't think that the only way to make it through this part of the industry or through this particular time in the industry is by having a really tiny operation or being part of a group. I don't think business is ever that black and white, or at least, you know, the economics behind business is never that black and white. I think that the truth is that right now there's examples of every type of business, you know, being successful. You know, it might not be abundant because we're at a really challenging part of the cycle, you know, economically speaking, but it's not as though there's only two specific profiles in the industry that are finding success or finding a way to stay afloat. Like, I think there's actually and look, we're really fortunate at the Mulberry Group because we, you know, as well as owning venues, we also own a coffee roastery, right? So through Square One Coffee Roasters, we get a really good read on what's happening throughout the industry, but also outside of our bubble. And, you know, I can tell you across our customer base, it's definitely not, you know, customers that are just in big groups that are doing really well. You know, there's a lot of businesses that are, you know, in that small to medium enterprise kind of category that are doing really phenomenal things and doing really amazing things and being rewarded for it, you know, through customers coming in time and time again. So I don't think, you know, that it's as bleak as that, you know, and I don't actually think that, you know, an industry that can only survive on tiny operations, you know, that are very hard to scale or massive groups, you know, that kind of have a lot of padding. I don't think that is a sustainable model anyway for any industry because, you know, it's really, really, you know, you're just talking about extremes there. There's not enough color in the middle. So I just come back to one simple thing, right? Which, and for me, when I talk about this stuff, like I'm pretty obsessed with business and business strategy in particular. And it might be a little bit of that old sort of cliche where, you know, to a person with a hammer, every problem is a nail. But I genuinely believe that you can solve every problem in business with the right strategy. And it doesn't really matter what part of the cycle that you're in. You know, every single industry is constantly going through a cycle of highs and lows, which are completely depicted by, you know, supply and demand and price and quantity and the equilibrium that those four factors can strike or not strike. And, you know, as long as you can actually understand the environment that you're in, and then design, you know, a strategy that makes sense and that is coherent around that environment, then you can navigate whatever environment is that you find yourself in. So it doesn't really matter to me. Like, I don't kind of look at it and say, oh, well, you know, this type of business is going to find it harder to do that or not. It's just not that simple. You know, I think what is really, really important is you have to be willing to do the work, right? You have to be willing to actually spend the time assessing the environment in the right way, you know, doing the right sort of research. You know, I think the article that you put out the other week was fantastic because, you know, there's a lot of people in our industry right now that aren't even having those conversations, you know, and when things are really tough and when you're in that difficult cycle of business where, you know, it feels like there's not enough customers to go around, it gets really, really challenging, you know, and I just think when it gets really challenging, that's all the more reason to be doing the strategy work. You know, it's, I think what happens is a lot of times in business, you find it hard to make ends meet and you go into survival mode a little bit. And then you just kind of feel like I'm just working in the business and I just have to right now because I'm struggling to make ends meet. And unfortunately, it's not as easy as that. It's like, yeah, you probably do have to work in the business more hours than you would like to, or more hours than you've ever worked before. But part of being in business is that you also have to still work on it. You know, you've got to find that time, you know, to still deploy strategy and design strategy and find out, you know, and find the, you know, the sources of information that will help you do that. Like, it's all out there. You know, there's resources available. There's people that do this stuff. And I just think it's about, you know, actually having that approach and not kind of getting too lost in your own sort of struggle for survival. You know, you have to kind of plan your way out. So I don't think it matters what type of business you find yourself in. I think what just matters is your approach.
So what are some of the fundamental questions or starting points for people?
So I think, like, there's a stack, right? And there's obviously, when it comes to strategy, the thing that makes it so hard is that there's no such thing as a silver bullet and there's no such thing as, you know, a one size fits all. It's if you think about it, right, every human being is unique, right? Therefore, every business that is started by different human beings is also going to be unique, right? And what that brings, what sort of comes about from that is this sense of identity. Every business has one. You know, there's no such thing as a business that exists just for the sake of it. You know, the businesses that do open, you know, just for the sake of it, they don't stay open long enough to care. You know, and I think anyone who's actually, you know, probably listening to this podcast probably does care, and you know, they probably have compromised a lot and given up a lot to, you know, to pursue their dreams of being in business, which means they've probably got a point to make, which means they're probably really passionate, which means I can almost bet my house on it that there's an underlying identity to that concept that might not be articulated, but it's 100% motivating everything that they do. And it definitely reflects what good looks like, you know, in the really good guest experiences. And it's just a matter of discovering it. So what I believe is that you can pick any strategy. I mean, you can literally jump on Google and just Google, you know, one page strategic plan template, and you'll find 10,000 options that you can fill out, right? And any of them will be good, right? Any of them will be useful. Just even if you just on your way home, stop in a random pub, grab a pint, grab any template and just fill it out. That will be a really, really productive 15 minutes of your time. But if you want to get really beneath the surface, right, and you really want to understand what are the factors that move the needle, there's a lot of research been done on this, right? So the first thing that really matters is identity. You know, if you don't have a clear sense of identity, then you don't really understand what it is that makes you different, right? You don't understand what it is that makes your offering different and your business different. And if you don't understand that, if you can't explain that simply, then you're not really giving your customers a reason to choose you over, you know, everyone else in what they might perceive as a fairly homogenous environment. So you have to do that, right? And like I said, everyone's got a point. If you have passion for what you do, then I guarantee you, you've got purpose and you've got identity, and you just have to go through the process of articulating it. So let's assume you've done that, right? For a lot of people, it's like, how well articulated is it? Like, what is the standard? Because I think for some people, they might say, yeah, I know my identity, it's really clear. It's like, all right, great, but how well do your staff understand it? You know, if we sort of randomly picked three members of staff, you know, from any business and just, you know, said to them separately, like, hey, give me the two-line elevator pitch on why this business exists, would each of those three statements be similar? Would they be exactly the same? Would they be wildly different? Like, that's an exercise that any business owner can run within 15 minutes any day of the week, right? And, I mean, it's literally one email that you need to send out and you'll be able to figure that out. And I just think if those answers that come back are really disparate, then you probably have to do a bit of work in terms of articulating that identity further. But say, for instance, you do that and those answers come back and they're pretty uniform, right? Like, they don't have to be verbatim, but close enough, you're probably good to go to move on to the next thing. And the next sort of factors that are really important are really just around product and consistency. You know, once you know that the identity is clear and it makes sense to your staff, it's like, cool, move on to the next phase. Because if that bit's not clear, if your identity is clear to you, but it's not clear to your staff, you can be certain it won't be clear to your customers. Right. So let's just assume that you've ticked that box, right? The vision's clear in your head. The identity is articulatable in a couple of, you know, impactful sentences. And then on top of that, you know, your staff can understand it as well as you can, right? You're good to go. So the next thing is really about product and consistency. And in our industry, product really just pertains to service and food, realistically, right? Or service and what people consume. And that's something that I think, again, is really measurable. You know, like, I think most business operators probably have a fairly intuitive idea, or let's call it a perception, as to the standard of their service and the standard of their product. And unless you really verify that, you might be, you know, from anything to a little bit off base to completely delusional, you know. And so I think you have to really check it, right? And there's great ways to do that. You know, obviously, there's, you know, lots of review platforms that you can access, but you can also just do it through discussion. You know, you can talk to a couple of your regulars. You can talk to a couple of people that, you know, you can talk to a few people that have never been to your business. And again, it's not a lot of work to try and just get a read outside of your own intuition as to what the standard of your product actually is. So let's also assume that, like, that's also good, right? Because I think very quickly when you start to analyze and audit the standard of your product, it's very rare that you go, yeah, I'm sweet. You know, you'll usually find a few little holes in the bucket that are pretty fixable. And that's actually quite exciting and inspiring again when you find what those things are, because you feel empowered, you know. And the thing I should say that underwrites this whole approach is that it's not about sort of just going, hey, you know what, the market's uncontrollable, so I just have to cop it. It's actually the opposite. It's saying, hey, you know what, I can't control interest rates and I can't control the cost of living, but at all times as a business owner, I can control the things that happen in my business. And I just, as long as you control those things with a fairly, you know, rudimentary degree of aptitude, then you actually, believe it or not, end up protecting yourself, you know, more against the things that you can't control. So I think once you look at that and you look at your product and you really audit it, you know, even just preliminarily, you'll find some things to do. You'll find some actions that you'll actually feel really empowered suddenly against this uncertain environment, because you're like, hey, you know what? I've got my fate back in my own hands and I'm doing things, you know, to really try and, like, survive and prosper. And so, yeah, I guess, like, you know, product and consistency, like I said, once you sort of look at your product and you audit it, you usually find a bit of gold. And then once you move on from that, it's about consistency. It's like, how consistent is this experience that I'm providing for people? You know, are they getting the same experience on Thursday night as they are on Saturday night? Or are they getting the same experience on this particular service when all my managers are working compared to others? You know, like, that's, again, easy to track, easy to manage, easy to improve. And then I think once you've sort of looked at all of those categories, right, you kind of go, hey, identity is really clear, which, believe it or not, informs the standard of your product as well. Because if your identity is clear and you hire great people, you can pretty much then get out of their way and let them, you know, execute the brief. But let's just assume, you know, your identity is clear, you're happy with your product, the consistency is really good. Then the last thing you have to be doing is just focusing on promo. You know, like, that's really critical, because once you actually start, you know, promoting what you do, you know, in fact, I think the days of just, like, word of mouth and stuff like that are pretty much gone. You know, you need to be pretty active out there now in terms of just creating awareness, and the cycle for people's attention is probably shorter than it's ever been before. Like, there was a time, I remember in some of my old businesses, where you get written up in broadsheet and you'd be busy for a week on the back of that, and that's just gone. Like, these days you get written up and 2 hours later it's lost in people's feeds, you know. So promo is probably that last piece, you know. It's really focusing on, you know, how can I create awareness around, you know, what I'm trying to do. And if you haven't got those first three categories in check, then you're really, really kneecapping, you know, what you can actually get out of promo, because you're probably just promoting something that's inconsistent or something that is a bit confusing or something that's just a bit suboptimal. So that's a really simple, you know, four-step approach that you can take right now into your business. Like, you don't need to pay a consultant to do a full-day whiteboard session with you. You can literally go down to the pub right now with a pen and a piece of paper and just think about those things, and you'll probably find you move the needle pretty quickly.
Leon, thank you for this Hospitality University. Absolutely love it.
Sorry, I'm being a bit preachy.
It's so good. No, I think, you know, if you could distill what you're saying to one bullet point, I think it's that people have more levers at their disposal than they might think. You know, I think a lot of people feel very buffeted by outside forces, but this idea of taking back control is so exciting. You know, what about, I mean, I know that you love the nitty gritty as well. You know, you find that exciting too. So what are some of the real, I don't know, when we're looking at a P&L or a balance sheet, what are some of the things that hospitality owners might be wanting to pick apart that, you know, perhaps they don't go into that detail as often as they could?
Yeah, look, I mean, so P&L is important. Balance sheet is important. I think a lot of people don't spend enough time actually looking at the balance sheet, but that's a bit of a can of worms. I think that is definitely something that if you are going to, you know, look at that and analyze that, probably get some advice on how to quantify it and qualify it. And that's something that, again, you know, hit up your bookkeeper, hit up your accountant. You know, if you're struggling to find information from them, hit up me. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. But I think the P&L is a good one, right? Because that's really accessible. It's very live, you know. It's very much like, you know, like with your balance sheet, it's a bit of a snapshot, and it's good for perspective. But P&Ls are great because it's going to tell you a live read on everything that's happening in your business. And the place that I would go straight away in this current climate is probably to overheads before I went anywhere else. Like, going to labor and going to COGS is kind of the, like, everyone does that. Well, hopefully, you know, everyone does that, because you have to be looking at those things, you know, every single week. I think it's really important, though, that in this sort of environment, right, like being in a cost of living crisis, I don't think Melbourne's ever been in one before, at least to this degree. And you have to be really careful, right? You have to really think about how, you know, the decisions that you make and the actions that you take in terms of just trying to bring down percentages of labor, you got to think about the impact that's going to have on the people, right, in your company. Because, again, I don't think anyone listening to this podcast would be super cutthroat about, you know, the commerciality about business. I think people are in it because they appreciate people and product and planet and all the good things. And, you know, I think you just have to be thinking about, like, how do I, you know, try to impact my labor? How do I try to impact that cost of labor, but do it in a way where it's not going to, you know, really make it difficult for the people that are on my roster? You know, I think for people that are working in casual employment right now, it's tougher than ever. And you have to be really creative about, you know, what can you do to try to, you know, help people out in ways like spread. So, I mean, as a quick example, one of the things that we started at the Mulberry Group, where when we started to analyze this stuff and realized, you know, hey, we can definitely be a bit smarter with labor, is rather than just sort of cutting people's hours, we kind of said to people, hey, you know what, like, in this particular venue right now, based on what we're forecasting, it's going to be hard to give everyone hours. But if you need extra hours, right, if you want extra hours or you really need them, let us know, because we can definitely find you hours across some of the other venues in our group. And even if not there, through our wholesale family, you know, through Square One Roastery. And it might not be, you know, working hours in the venue of choice that you have, but at least, you know, you'll be working somewhere that's trusted, and it's a place that that, you know, really cares. And I think you got to be thinking like that a little bit. So I think like labor right now, COGS, like that's just stock standard, right? But I think one thing that people don't often think about enough is overheads. And overheads are kind of easy to forget. You know, it's kind of, you forget about that app that you subscribed to thinking it was going to change your life, and then you stopped using it, you know, after a week, and then and now you're still paying, you know, $11.99 a month and not even thinking about it. And so there's all these really simple ways that if you actually just jump on Xero, right, and just download or export that chart of accounts, right, all your overheads that are coming out, and just look at it on a spreadsheet, it's a little bit scary because you realize how much slippage there is. Like you kind of look at it and go, oh my God, I can't believe we're spending that much money a month on subscriptions. So when you actually then, you know, start to dig a little bit deeper and you uncover that there's, you know, these particular items that you spend, you might look at it and it's only going to save you a couple hundred bucks a month, but everything like that counts, right? Like you find, you know, five or six little things like that and suddenly that's $1,000, right? So I think overheads is a really smart place to look. You can also look at things like just the amount of stock that you're holding, you know, and the amount, like, you know, a simple one that happened for us, which was quite interesting, was one of our managers was just looking at the amount of laundry that we were sitting on, right? And they were sort of just like, look, do we need to be topping that up, you know, to this amount all the time? Like, let's just see what happens if next week, instead of ordering the same standing order, maybe I'll just order 80% of what we usually get, you know, and, you know, they did that and nothing happened, right? Like it was totally fine. And so the week after that, they did another 80%, you know, and nothing happened again. And then by the third time they ordered, you know, 80% again and shit hit the fan. They're like, all right, cool. Now I know where the point is, you know, but those little things, like when you can actually just look at all the overheads that you just don't see day to day and week to week, like there's a lot of room there to reduce things. And again, it's like you can just shave those overheads by 3 or 4%. It can be quite significant.
Absolutely. Leon, I'd love you to talk about training and staff development, because I think that's one of the things that people, you know, can take their eye off when they're, yeah, when the wheels are really spinning.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's usually, you know, when people go into that survival mode and, you know, they get a little bit short-sighted, I think it's usually marketing and promo and training and development that are the first things to just get bumped off the list. And, you know, it's really so unfortunate because it's to that business's detriment, you know. And I think the truth is, like, we're in a particularly difficult period in hospitality, right? Like, obviously, economically, it's tough and it's always been tough. And, you know, they talk about, like, talent dilution, and they talk about the amount of people that have left the industry and all the rest of it, right? It's now more than ever that it's really, really important to be building systems into your organization that enable you to not have to just hire the best talent, but enable you to actually build the best talent, right? Like that's such an important distinction, because I think, again, most of the people listening to this podcast, they're probably really passionate about what they do, which means they've probably got a fair bit of knowledge and wisdom to impart. It's just a matter of actually making the time to do it. You know, the amount of talented managers that I've worked for or worked with that are just too busy, you know, to actually stop and appreciate the responsibility, and I would go as far as to say obligation, that they have as a leader to coach and nurture the people around them. You know, it's so important, but it's not necessarily the thing that is in your KPIs, or it's not necessarily the thing that's going to be talked about all the time in your one-on-one, but it's just when you actually understand that, hey, I've earned the privilege of being in a position of leadership, I think it's really important, and it sounds a bit over the top, but I literally think it's on a daily basis that you should really embrace that responsibility and really think about how to impart wisdom and nurture the people around you. Because again, if you can go into your business every day with a mindset of, hey, how do I help people grow? In no time, right, you'll spend like a few months of just adopting that philosophy. And before you know, like you know, 3 months down the track, you'll look back and just go, wow, look at all these amazing people I've got in my company, rather than, oh, that guy's a good person, but he just doesn't know how to do this thing. Or I just wish that person was more experienced in this area. It's like, hey, believe it or not, you know, we are the experienced leaders and operators in the business that can impact that. It's just a matter of actually being conscious about it. So I think it's really important to think about how do I just not just do it? Like, how do I come up with a 12-month growth and development plan? It's like, yeah, you got to do all that stuff. But just thinking about it in the day, even in an unstructured way, just waking up every morning and thinking, hey, how can I actually think about the people that I work with and how can I help them take that next little granular step on their journey? That is really, really going to make a difference. And I think that mindset, if you stick with it for long enough, it really then enables you to come up with great innovations. Like one of the things that we did here recently, which was just so amazing to do, was we ran, it was only a few weeks ago, we ran a day which we called Hospitality Camp. So we called it like the Mulberry Group Hospitality Camp. And what we did was we took all the managers from all the venues off site for a day, right? We took them to our new site in Abbotsford, which hasn't been built yet. And we set up a little pop-up cafe in the morning, brought everyone in, you know, made coffee and, you know, had some amazing loon croissants, you know, for breakfast. And then we sort of just went up and we really just got everyone together to talk about where we're at right now as an organization and how important hospitality is to us, right? We talked about guest experience and we talked about warm hospitality and we talked about our ethos and, you know, how we want to embrace it. And then we kind of let everyone else plan from there. You know, we had everyone split up into breakout sort of groups and they just spent most of the day talking about how, as really experienced professionals, they could implement some of these things, you know, in order to create a better guest experience. Because that's the thing that we've all sort of committed to. One of the things that really galvanizes, you know, everyone at the Mulberry Group is we've all sort of, you know, chosen this life of, you know, a career where we're in the service of others. You know, that's the thing that we've committed to. So just taking that time, right? Like so many people look at that and go, man, that is just such a logistical challenge. It's just, it's expensive or it's costly and it's or just to get everyone together. But I can tell you know, the energy that came out of this session, and it, you know, it's really motivated us to the point where we're gonna run that camp 3 times a year. You know, we just want to be able to get everyone in our group together and galvanize around what it is that we really want to do, which is, you know, create amazing hospitality. But that in itself is learning and development. That is training. You know, it's a bit more conceptual than say, here's a, you know, 5-step sequence of service model, or, you know, here's how to dial in an espresso. But I think like that's the training that really counts, you know, at a time like this.
But I think also, you know, if someone thinks, okay, well, I just know I won't be able to do that at least right now. I mean, give us an example from your long career of something that's just happened in the moment that's been quite transformative in terms of training.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so many. You know, I think I can say safely that I've made that many mistakes and those have been some of my most, you know, potent learning opportunities. But I think it's just something simple, right? Like, you know, you might be mid-service and maybe it's just a quiet day, right? Like maybe, you know, you've got a cafe and you get into lunch service and it's 1 o'clock and it just hasn't popped off for whatever reason, right? Like right now, everything's pretty unpredictable. You know, there's just in that moment right there, you can sort of grab someone who's working on the floor, who's expressed a bit of an interest in making coffee and chuck them on, you know, and just say, hey, why don't we spend half an hour on the machine right now? You know, it's just a small step. It's just a little bit of exposure. But you know what? If it gets really busy, we can swap back, you know, but that's just a really simple way to give people exposure into other sections, right? Provided they want to do that, which I think that starts with just conversations, right? Like chatting to your team. And again, you don't have to sit down and have an hour long, you know, review with every person on your team to understand what their desires are for learning and development, right? Like you can just send out a simple form on, you know, a simple Google form to everyone that works on your team. And the people that don't really have those aspirations just probably won't fill it out. But the people that do, you should really listen to that, you know, because that's very, very valuable insight. And it's, again, you don't have to think like, hey, in order to do training and development, I've got to have the greatest learning and development program, or I need something super sophisticated, or I need to build like a digital learning academy like LinkedIn do, right? You don't have to do that stuff, you know, just understanding that, hey, that person over there, is, you know, someone who works on the floor but has expressed an interest in learning how to make cocktails, or has expressed an interest in, you know, learning how to run service. It's like, great. Those opportunities exist all around you. You just have to think about them, you know, and identify them and then act on them.
Love that. So speaking of opportunities that potentially lie all around us, let's, I guess, round off this conversation with AI. I think, you know, we all hear about it. We know it's out there. We know it's creeping closer. You know, we intersect with it in our daily lives, even if we don't know it now. What are you thinking about ways that you might be able to implement it at Mulberry Group?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've thought about it a lot and had a bunch of great discussions. I'd love to say that we've implemented, you know, a bunch of stuff and have gone full circle where we can actually measure value. We're not that far yet, but there's definitely things that we've thought about a lot and dabbled with that I think I can share. I think probably the three main ones, as nascent as they are, would be around, funnily enough, identity that I was, you know, harping on about before. Another one is probably in, you know, HR and culture, and, you know, which extends into learning and development a little bit. And the other one is just around costings. So to give you a little bit more insight into those, you know, I think a really great way that you can sometimes understand the identity of a business is usually not just from asking the founder. It's, believe it or not, it's from asking the customers, right? Sometimes when you go to your best customers and you ask them, hey, why do you choose us? You know, why do you choose us every week over someone else? You know, like, what's the reason for that? The responses are amazing, you know, and often they're things that, you know, mostly they'll be things that you expect, but sometimes you just get these little gems that have been in your blind spot. And you go, oh, that's funny you mentioned that. I spent so much time doing that thing, I don't even realize that I do it, you know. And so I think that's really important. So a way that you can use AI for that, right, is if you take, say, all of your review data, right, so from Google reviews to, you know, Seven Rooms or whatever it is you use, if you can just somehow, it might be a little bit of elbow grease, but if you can take all of that and get it onto one document, then you can actually dump that into an AI filter and just ask it to recognize what are the most common and strongest positive themes. You know, and just that alone will actually give you a really good sense of what you're doing well that you might not know you're doing well because you just do it so naturally. And so I think there's things like that that you can do that really inform identity. I think the other thing I was talking about, like a simple one, is just around like costs and expenses. Like, you know, we're exploring, you know, when it comes to building cost, right? Like when you sort of plan to build a new venue, and you kind of look at the guy, let's just say it's going to, you know, you kind of look at it and you say, hey, our budget is like 600 grand and you go to a builder, you know, it's guaranteed the quote's going to come back at like 800 grand. And so you go, okay, how do I get that 800 down to 600? Usually what you'll do is you'll sit down, you know, with the builder and you'll do a line by line, you know, cost saving analysis where you look at everything. Can we use a different material here? Can we do that differently? And you'll just try to get it back down into that 600 ballpark. So, you know, you can actually, again, instead of just having two humans doing that discretionally, you can punch that into an AI filter and just say, hey, you know, save me, you know, 20% or whatever without diluting the quality. And I'm not saying it's going to come out and give you like this perfect blueprint, but it's going to give you something that you can then take into the line-by-line analysis that you then do with the builder, and it might even just save you a bit of time so that you can spend, you know, the human qualities to be a little bit more creative. And I guess the last one is just around like HR and the benefit, I think, that can really help the industry, especially right now when resources are a little bit scarce. Like what I kind of think about with HR that is so challenging is it is very, very intricate. You know, like I think for us, like, we've got someone who manages that for the whole company and she's amazing and she's great and super talented, and it's still really complicated. You know, so imagine how hard it is for managers that might not have access to that resource, or, you know, even if you do have access to that resource, but it, your time is a bit skint, you know, so how can you use AI for things like that? It's actually really, really, it's a very practical tool. So, you know, what I would say is that, like, if you're sort of sitting there thinking, hey, how do I build a learning and development growth plan for, you know, one of the people in my team, or sometimes in a not so good situation, you know, depending on how you look at it, how do I create a performance improvement plan for this person that isn't quite performing at the level that they need to be? You know, right now, how we do that is completely discretionary. You know, like, a manager will sit there and go, okay, well, I've never freaking done this before, or I haven't had heaps of experience in this area, so I'm just going to have a crack at it. You know, or they'll tend to sort of look at their manager that they report to and say, hey, can I book in some time with you to help me with this? And now you've got two people, you know, looking at it and trying to solve it. And again, it's going to be complicated. It takes a lot of time and it can be a little bit stressful. But if you were to take that and punch it into an AI filter, right? Like, say you just opened a Google Doc and you set up the dictation, you turn the dictation on and you just talk at it. You don't even have to be refined in any way, right? Don't filter it. Just crap on about what is going on. What, you know, how is this person not performing? What's the backstory? What's the context? Or who is this person? What are their learning aspirations? And why is that important? And what are some of the risks? Just crap on for, you know, 6 or 7 minutes about what it is, and then punch that document into an AI filter and say, hey, turn this into a coherent case study. Then you put that case study into an AI filter again and say, hey, tell me how to solve this problem. Give me advice on how I should design that performance improvement plan, let's just say. It's going to give you something that's pretty good. It might not be 100% perfect, but it's, I reckon it would probably be anywhere from 60 to 70, maybe 80% valuable. And then when you sit down with your manager for advice, or then when you actually sit down as an experienced person that can see the color to, you know, to tweak that plan, you're kind of already starting with, you know, over half the job done, you know, which just enables you to add more value philosophically. So I think things like that are really, really good ways to be able to really harness the technology that exists for us right now. I think too many times people kind of trip themselves up a little bit by expecting technology to just be an already perfect solution. You know, you kind of always think, oh, I just need to buy that app and I'm just going to pull it out of the box and it's going to naturally just plug into my life. And it never works like that, you know, like, all technology needs a little bit of elbow grease to customize it, you know, to your specific needs. And I think if you're not prepared to do that little bit, then it sometimes makes technology a little bit harder to approach. But I think in this instance, it's just about thinking about it as an 80% solution. You still need to apply that 20%, but you may as well use it, you know, to get you 80% of the way there, because it's going to save you heaps of time and possibly even add value that you might not have thought of.
Leon, love it. So let's finish with some words of, I don't know, comfort, inspiration, empowerment. Someone who perhaps wakes up in the morning and all the thoughts rush in, you know, about all the pressure points in their business. What's an attitude that they could take into the day?
Yeah, so I think, again, it's a bit of a, like, it's not a very sexy word, but I always come back to it and say, the attitude you should take into the day should be strategic, right? It should be planned and it should be measured. And, you know, if you find that it's 1:30 in the morning, you know, or it's, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever, and you just wake up because you can't sleep because you've got so much on your mind, the best thing you can do is just write it down. Just sit down and just make a list of all those things that are in your head that are kind of literally keeping you up at night. And suddenly when you actually just see it as a list in front of you, it becomes a lot more manageable. I'm a very big advocate for meditation, and effectively that's what meditation does, right? Like, it's mental filing. It clears all your unresolved thoughts. And, you know, if you don't really get down with that, then, and you're a bit more pragmatic, then I just think making a list, believe it or not, is a very, very powerful thing that you can do on a daily basis. And again, I think, so if you wake up with all the thoughts rushing in, I think you just need to meet that with a plan.
Love it. Leon, such an empowering chat. I think it's going to mean a lot to people and something people will, yeah, listen to once and then come back to. So thank you so much for sharing your insights today. Really grateful. I'm excited. I think this chat's really going to make a difference. So appreciate it.
Mate, that's been an absolute pleasure, Danny. Thanks for having me.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta at Dirty Linen Podcast. We can't wait to hear from you.